now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Scripture tells us to train up our children in the way they should go, but apparently the government doesn't like us intruding on what they consider their turf. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. Our guest is a friend that we've spoken to a number of times, but not for quite a while. And in fact, the last time we talked, he was still hosting a podcast called The Jesus Geek. But he seems to have found his calling now as he produces a weekly program or a regular program that helps those who homeschool their children stay on top of how they can best use technology in that setting. It's our pleasure and our honor to welcome back to the bunker John Wilkerson. John, thanks for joining us. It's good to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me on, Derek. I've been a listener for a long time and been on a couple times. I think I've even interviewed you once or twice.
Yeah.
And I had the Jesus Geek podcast, and it's always great to talk with you.
Yeah, the current podcast that you produce, is it weekly, The Wired Homeschool?
It is weekly, yes.
Okay. I should have, bad host not doing my research, but was diving into some research this morning on a topic I'm sure that homeschoolers cover, which is the creation versus evolution debate. More evidence coming out that, we're finding blood cells and collagen inside dinosaur bones that are 75 million years old. And how can that be when collagen can't be preserved for more than 2 million? Anyway, that's a whole nother story.
Yes, it is.
The big story in the news this week, besides Don't Call Me Bruce, is the last couple of weeks now, the Duggar family featured prominently on one of those reality shows that are all over cable TV. And the disclosure that one of the sons, the 19 children that the Duggar family has, Josh, was admitted to inappropriate sexual contact with one of his sisters when they were younger.
Yes.
This type of story, and probably because they've been so prominent, their show has been on TLC for a number of years now, because they're in the public eye. This is a sensational story. But stories like this, when something comes out about a homeschooling family, it seems to get more play in the media than when we hear about something like this happening in a public school setting. Am I being overly sensitive here, or is this a trend that you've noticed?
No, not at all. In fact, a few weeks before all this information came out about Josh Duggar, there was a number of news articles about parents who, left their children alone at a park to play. And it was blown up because these homeschooling parents allow their kids to walk a half mile to a park and stay there as long as they want during the day and then come back. That's something we all did as kids growing up.
Yeah. It's a little different world now than it was then, but you're right. That was not unusual at all. My sister and I used to ride our bikes a lot farther than that without parental supervision to go play with our friends.
Yeah. So often what happens when you see these things, the media tends to jump on it, and the media on the right and the left actually tends to jump on it, and they use it as another bully pulpit to either promote or disdain Christians, especially Christian homeschoolers. And I think what happens is people look at the Duggars, or they look at other homeschoolers, or Westboro Baptist Church, and they throw them up as a caricature of either homeschoolers or Christians and say, see, they're all like this. And this is something that it has always occurred in the media. It's going to continue to occur because it makes headlines and people will read it and watch it and listen to it. But it's something that I think is becoming a little bit more subversive because we live in the kind of world where everything has to be encapsulated into a 15-second sound bite and 140 characters.
Right.
And so that means people are getting their news from with a very myopic view of what's actually going on and what actually happened.
Yeah, and it's easier to try to simplify it down to caricatures because people, as you say, have been sort of Twitterized to expect things in small little bike-sized chunks. USA Today, when you sort of started this this trend in journalism, it was derisively referred to by some in the media as McPaper, as you know, little bite-sized, easily digestible nuggets of news instead of actual in-depth reporting. But the sad truth is, if people didn't like that kind of of approach, USA Today would have gone under. We wouldn't all be tweeting and Facebooking, and that wouldn't be how we get the news. And unfortunately, the meme seems to be, and again, correct me if I'm being overly sensitive here, that parents who are homeschooling are in some way a danger to their children because they're not allowing their children to be properly socialized, or perhaps they're being inculcated with dangerous anti-societal ideas. Again, am I being overly sensitive here?
No, I don't think so. There is a segment of the media and a segment of the, I guess you call them the ruling elite. I don't like using that term because it makes me sound like a tinfoil hat wearing paranoid freak job.
Yeah, and it's a very broad brush.
Right, it's a very broad brush. But these people truly, honestly think that the state can do a better job of raising children than parents can, and it is scary. It is frightening, and unfortunately, that means we also have to have kind of. You got to have someone to balance that out. And so you have people way over on the far right who say, look, the government has no business in anyone's life based on anything. And what happens within the four walls of my house and my family, no one needs to know about it. And that even if it means a crime is being committed or whatever is going on. So we have these two extremes on each end going at each other in the media. And everybody in the middle is dodging bullets.
Now, you say that those on the right, and right should be put into air quotes because it's, you know, they've gone so far to the right that they've kind of lapped around and met up
right.
With the left again. Why would the right, which supposedly is the defender, the side of the political spectrum that defends the rights of parents and the rights of individuals versus the overreaching power of the government, why would they be critical of the homeschooling movement?
Well, they're generally not critical of the homeschool movement, but what they do is they try to gain the support and attention of the homeschool movement. And you're starting to see that in a lot of these announcements for political campaigns. They're going to homeschool conventions and they're drawing these homeschoolers in saying, we're for parental rights. We're for homeschooling. We're for all these things. And then what happens is they get into office and they just do whatever everyone else has done in the past, which is follow the script. And so they're kind of courting the homeschool groups and they are really. It's unfortunate because I see this has been happening for years among homeschoolers. And whenever I see a homeschool convention that has a keynote speaker that involves a politician, I typically want to just steer away from it and not even bother with it because I know this person, they're just coming in there to basically try and get more votes for them. And as we've seen time and time again, when you look at the voting records of all these politicians, they all pretty much vote the same way, except on a few of the kind of keystone positions for each of the parties. And if we want more of the same, then we can just continue on the way that we're going, or we can really look at these politicians, and we have to, I think, start a grassroots movement at the local level where we're impacted a lot more directly by laws and legislation than on the national level.
What are some of the challenges, legal challenges, regulatory challenges that homeschooling parents face?
Well, it varies from state to state and country to country. In some states, there's very, very little regulation. It just requires sending a letter saying, hey, I'm homeschooling my kids, and that's it. And there's zero oversight after that. And in a state like where I live in New York, we have to report quarterly. There's certain information that the superintendent of the school district looks for. We have to have regular testing. And there are even some states that it's hard to believe, but their regulations are even stricter than in New York. That's starting to change. And we're starting to see some of those really strict regulations loosen up as people look at homeschooling and see the success stories in homeschooling and say, look, these parents really can do it on their own. But even more concerning is around the world, homeschooling is starting to get more and more restrictive. And the reason that concerns me is because our government officials like to look at what the rest of the world is doing and start passing laws for our country based on what Germany or Italy or Spain or some of these other countries are doing.
Yes.
And they have extremely, it's either illegal or the requirements to homeschool are so high, it's virtually impossible.
The what are some of the criticisms that you face that parents maybe have absorbed impressions of homeschooling from the culture around us, and when they find out that you're homeschooling, what are some of the questions or maybe misimpressions, misunderstandings people have about homeschooling? You know, how do your children learn how to deal with other kids? You know, things like that. What do you encounter?
Well, obviously, the socialization question is the biggest issue that typically tends to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to look at the parent and say, are you sending your kids to school to learn to socialize, or do you want them to get an education? And so then they kind of scratch their head and look at me, and I say, you see my kids out there on that soccer field? They're socializing. When they go to 4-H, they're socializing. When they go out and play at the park or go to the skate park, they're socializing. So the whole socialization myth, it's starting to die down, but there are people who still hold on to that and think that, well, you know, kids should be in a classroom with everyone who's the same age. Well, why? We don't live like that. We don't work like that. I work with people as young as 22 years old up to people in their 70s. None of us went to school together.
And look back at the history of the country. My mother taught in a one-room schoolhouse in North Dakota for a short time, and she had everything from K through 12 in that classroom. And
exactly.
That's the way it was for much of America's history, because you just didn't have enough kids to pack 30 into a classroom and segregated by age.
Exactly. And another myth that tends to come up is that, well, homeschoolers, especially Christian homeschoolers, they're all like the Duggars. They have huge families and they don't dance. They don't watch TV. You know, all these things that the Duggars have implemented in their own home based on their own convictions. And so they think everyone who's a Christian homeschooler is like that. And in fact, we're starting to see a rise in secular homeschoolers, which I love because they're bringing new ideas and new approaches to different topics. And in fact, there's also a rise among African Americans now, especially who live in inner city areas where the schools are just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting homeschool. So it's not all just, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants that are homeschooling now. Now we have atheists, we have Jews, we have blacks, we have Muslims. We have a number of the diversity is getting much better here in our country. And I think it's exciting to see that. It gives opportunities for me as a Christian to record a podcast that's going to be heard from people from all walks of life. And as one secular homeschooler put it, my podcast is secular friendly, because I'm talking about technology, and technology is agnostic. So it's very easy and approachable. And then if people want to talk to me about my personal approach to homeschooling and my personal philosophies about homeschooling, that gives me an opportunity to share Jesus with them.
Yeah, I found that to be the case in my my former career as an outside salesman for a steel company. Steel fabrication is also agnostic. You don't need to be a Christian in order to make farm implements or coal mining equipment. But sometimes the opportunity arises as you develop relationships with people about a common interest. You know, what do we do with this material? Can we use it for this, that, and the other? Then to just carry the conversation outside the bounds of the original topic of discussion. So what are the big challenges then for homeschoolers, especially as relates to technology? I would imagine one of the objections some parents might have to homeschooling is we can't provide the same resources that they have at the public school.
Right. And that is a challenge. And I think homeschoolers have gotten very creative with the way that they've done that. But one of the interesting things to see is some of these school districts that have implemented these iPad programs, they're finding that they're failing because they just thought they would throw technology at a problem and it would be a magic bullet. And it hasn't. It hasn't worked. I think we all know from experience that technology is not a magic bullet that will solve all of your problems.
Yeah, it's sort of like transhumanism.
Right. Exactly.
As regards the problem of death. Yeah.
Right. So, sure, we have challenges as far as, especially in my house where I'm raising seven kids. My oldest, he's going to be a senior in college next year. And I have another one who's going to be eight in August. So I've got a ways to go on this. And I've got a bunch of used laptops that I have set up that I got for free. So we have to find ways, if the wallet isn't as thick, to basically get creative. And if someone is giving away or throwing away a laptop and it still runs, then you grab it and you say, hey, I'll take that. And you give it to one of your kids. So that certainly is a challenge. And I would like to see, although I tend to not want to legislate things, especially as it relates to homeschoolers, because I'll give you an example with the whole, I'm sure you've seen the coverage of the Tim Tebow laws, that these are laws that are being passed to allow homeschoolers to participate in public school sports.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that these same homeschool parents who say, we want to keep the government out of us educating our children, still want to say, oh, but we want the government to give us access to playing sports. So they want the government out of one portion of their lives, but are willing to let the government in another portion of their lives.
Human nature. No, you can't have your cake and eat it too. The government giveth and the government taketh away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
However, I would be for a tax credit for homeschoolers, because we still pay our school taxes,
right?
But our kids don't get the benefit of using that public school. Just like here in New York, we have a number of tax credits that are available to the elderly who own property because they don't have kids in school. And so there's a program here called the STAR program, and the state refunds part of their taxes because they're not using that tax money, you know, to their own personal gain. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind a $500 or $1,000 tax credit. At the same time, I also don't mind that they don't give it to me, because if it's something that gets passed, that's fine. If not, I will find a way to make it work. I've been doing it for 17 years and I'll keep doing it.
Well, but my dad, after he retired, mom and dad moved from the Chicago area down to South Carolina, and dad got very active in a food pantry run by the church that they became members of. And they had the opportunity to accept government cheese, you know, surplus government cheese that was being bought up from dairy farmers. And they thought about it and ultimately decided against it because these retired guys, there was like a, three retired guys who'd all been pretty successful in business. You know, one, my dad, the engineer, another guy, the salesman, you know, who'd had a successful career as a real estate entrepreneur, and another fellow that was friends of theirs. They realized pretty quickly that if we accept the government aid, it will come with not just strings, but steel cables attached. Yeah, pushing too hard for government assistance is one of those situations where you have to be careful what you wish for.
Exactly. And I understand why parents want their homeschool kids to play sports in public schools, because it can lead to really great opportunities like college scholarships.
Right, sure.
So that's completely understandable. However, it's a very slippery slope. Because what will start happening is they'll start saying, okay, you can play. And then they'll say, okay, well, you can play if, and then they'll start attaching all these requirements. Mm-hmm. And now you're not even, now you're really getting into an area where you want the government out of your education. But again, like I said, you actually said it even better. You want to eat your cake and have it too, and which you can't do.
How about criticism from so-called experts who are concerned about the welfare, or who claim that they're concerned about the welfare of children, and again point to a situation like the Duggar family, saying, you know, this is something that wouldn't have happened, the inappropriate sexual contact, if they had been in a setting where they were supervised outside the home. How much of that criticism do you see?
I don't see a lot of it. I do see some of it. But I look at that criticism and I say, you know, your criticism's completely invalid because it happens to kids in public school too. And to say that it happens among homeschoolers at a higher rate than it happens to kids in public school, we don't have any statistics on that. And so there's no way that you can make an informed statement and say a child is at higher risk of something like this if they're homeschooled. There was a case in, I think, Michigan a few months ago, where a woman who claimed to have been homeschooling her children, they were found in a dumpster dead or something like that. Oh. And people started pointing the finger and saying, see, we need to tighten our homeschooling laws because this was a homeschool lady and this would have never happened if we had better regulation. You know, public school kids get found dead all the time, and is not as big a news story as if it's someone who claimed they were homeschooling their children. So are these situations tragic? Absolutely. There's no denying it. And did someone take advantage of the system? Absolutely. There's no denying it. But it happens with everyone from all aspects of life. And until someone can actually do a study and show me and say, if they're homeschooling, you're at greater risk for this, I'm just going to say you're full of hot air. And you need to really evaluate whether or not the problem is homeschooling, or if the problem runs a little bit deeper than someone just decided to homeschool.
Mm-hmm. In other words, situation that might occur in the home, whether the child was attending school 6 or 8 hours a day or not.
Right.
Well, let's talk about lifestyle. What sort of challenges do homeschooling parents face in their lifestyle when they take that step?
Well, my wife famously, as far as I'm concerned, coined the phrase that homeschooling actually is a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And that when you choose to homeschool, especially for a woman, because let's face it, they are 95% of the ones who do 95% of the homeschooling. Mm-hmm. They are now choosing to spend nearly every waking hour with their children.
I can just imagine listeners already beginning to shudder.
Oh. Exactly. In a society where we send our kids off to school for 6 to 8 hours a week when they turn 5 years old, or maybe even 4 years old, because we want them in a pre-K program.
That's right. We got to have Head Start. Yeah,
exactly. So this is a lifestyle choice. You were choosing to spend the majority of your waking hours with your children. And that with it brings additional stress, but it also brings with it great, great rewards. And I don't think anything is worth doing if it's easy. And homeschooling definitely is not easy. You're going to face opposition from family. You're going to face opposition from friends. It is more accepted these days, but there are still people who are just dead set against it for whatever reasons they may have. And so when you make this choice, you're usually choosing to give up a second income. So you have to really adjust everything that you do. You have to adjust the way you spend money, how fancy of a house or car you're going to drive. It really impacts everything in your life. And it's not just something that you're going to just decide to do one day and it's going to be, you know, rainbows and unicorns. Hmm. It's more like screaming and yelling and, you know, Tasmanian devils all over the place.
But, you know, we live in a society where, and I read the statistic years ago when our daughter was still young. And I wound up spending a lot of time with her when she was younger than most fathers because I was in the radio business. I was broadcasting. And that's an industry where you can find yourself out of work on a moment's notice and without cause. And it did happen to me several times. In fact, in the broadcasting industry, I'm told that you're not really – you haven't really made it until you've been fired at least three times. So I can say honestly that I made it in secular broadcasting. But most men, most fathers, according to the study that I saw – and again, this was probably 20 years ago – spent an average of 15 minutes a day or less with their children, which to me is almost criminal. Why has our society gotten to the point where not only is that considered normal for men, but now because women are expected to go out and pursue a full-time career as well as being a mother. And when they do that, there's no way they can spend very much time with their children on a daily basis either. We are essentially delegating the raising of our children to schools and to daycare.
Yeah. Yeah. We have been sold a lie, Derek, and it's called the American dream. And it is unfortunate that so many people keep swallowing this lie that the harder you work, the more fulfilled you will be. And now I'm not saying don't work hard, but what I'm saying is that the more you work and the more you earn and the more you buy, the more fulfilled you'll be. And so parents are pursuing this. They want to make and rightfully so, they want to make their children more comfortable than they were when they grew up. But you know what? Life isn't about comfort. Life is about doing hard things, and sometimes we have to be uncomfortable. And I think if more parents were willing to say, we're instead of working 50 or 60 hours a week, so that I can earn a little extra money and spend $10,000 on a vacation to Disney, how about you just not work the extra hours and spend that time with your kids? But people don't want to do that for some reason or another. And I really think it has to do with we all have status symbols in our lives, whether it's our house, our car, our title at work, whatever it may be. And to me, the best status symbol is husband and father.
Mm-hmm. Amen,
and
brother.
Mother, wife. Mm-hmm. Those are the four greatest status symbols in the world. But we've been told both by feminists and also by this, since the Industrial Revolution, men have been told you're only as good as the last job that you had. Mm-hmm. And it is just it's such a lie that we swallow that we have to have the house and the car and the pool and the clothes and we have to be members of these clubs and we have to do all these certain things to be fulfilled in life. When we can find fulfillment in being a husband and a father and a mother and a wife. And that's not to say we can't pursue other things, but sometimes we may have to put our pursuit of a career on hold because now we have children, and that's a higher calling than landing a six-figure job and the title of assistant vice president or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. It is a lie that we have swallowed from the God of this world. And especially for women, wives who take on this responsibility are often looked down upon. And you can just read the condescension and the disdain in the media directed at women who choose to stay home and be full-time mothers, even if they're not homeschooling. It is tragic. As far as the resources that you need to pull together to provide a good, solid educational foundation for your kids, what are the biggest challenges that you and your wife have had to overcome?
I'd say the biggest challenge that we've had to overcome is just deciding what we want, what curriculum we want to use. My wife is a certified teacher. She's got a master's degree in math. So she knows how to teach. We kind of have a leg up on other homeschool parents who maybe don't have a parent in the family that was an educator. And so it's never really been a challenge of how to teach or what to teach. It's just really been a challenge of finding just that right curriculum. And I'll tell you why. Part of the reason is that what we have found is that some of the, especially the science books that are written from a creationist viewpoint, are very light on science. Mm. And I think they're trying to avoid the hard questions, and they're more interested in talking about how God created everything, which I fully agree with. Mm-hmm. But they don't really want to get into the science of things and say, this is why this works. Let's really break this down and look at it. And so there are times we will look to secular resources because they give us the level of detail that we want. And so if there's any Christian curriculum authors out there, please fill your science books with more science. We love the fact that you're taking it from a Christian worldview. That's great. But you know what? I don't need a scripture on every page reminding me that God created everything. What I need on the pages of this book is science and information and how to do good science, mm-hmm. and not just repeat rhetoric, whether it's from any point of view, because that's what so many people do these days is they repeat rhetoric. Whether you're Bill Nye the Science Guy or you're Ken Ham, that people are taking information and these, again, right? We're in this headline Twitter, Twitterizing of America.
Yeah, the Twitterverse.
And so no matter what point of view they're coming from, instead of actually looking at the science and making a decision for themselves, they just kind of hold up their expert there and start throwing quotes at you from them.
Right.
And yeah. And this is – we cannot – we have to be honest with ourselves as Christians and say there is good science out there. Even if it's done by someone who's an atheist, it's okay for us to reference that because truth is truth. And if God created it and God put these things in motion – we can teach our children how to, as they say, chew the hay and spit out the stubble. Mm-hmm. And because they're going into a world that is going to be, that's dominated by a humanistic worldview and a worldview that is based on biological evolution of molecules to man. And so they need to know how to have answers for that.
Right.
And unfortunately, I'm not seeing that in the books. So that's our biggest challenge is finding these books that will challenge the thinking of our kids instead of just repeating what they got from somewhere else.
You say that, and correctly, that most families aren't going to have a somebody with a master's degree in the household available to teach. And I suspect for some, looking at the prospect of homeschooling their kids is a bit intimidating. You know, how can I teach these kids when I don't really grasp trigonometry myself? What are we going to do when we get to that level? What recommendations, what advice would you give to parents who are looking for a good curriculum that they can feel comfortable presenting as non-experts?
Well, one of the things you can do is you can join a homeschool co-op, which is one of the things that we have done. And so the subjects that either my wife doesn't want to take the time to teach because she's wanting to focus on something else, another parent can do that for us. And when we get together, I think the kids get together once a week. The other option would be to go to homeschooling conventions. And when you go to a homeschooling convention, especially if it's your first time and you're thinking about homeschooling, you're going to hit this thing called the vendor floor and your jaw is going to drop because there are going to be hundreds, if not thousands of tables there of people trying to sell you their curriculum. And unfortunately, that can be it seems like a very daunting task because everyone's telling you that theirs is the best and theirs is the most godly and the one with the best Christian worldview whatever superlatives they want to use about their curriculum. So before you go to that conference and you're kind of thinking about this, ask other people who homeschool what they use. And challenge those people and say, what don't you like about the curriculum that you're using? Because one of the things that my wife has been able to do, again, because she's a trained teacher, she has been able to take portions of certain curriculum and just kind of mix and match as needed. Mm-hmm. So if we're hitting a particular topic and she doesn't like the way it's presented in one book, she moves to another book. Or teaches it on her own, or whatever the case may be. You know, like I said, this is a lifestyle choice. Now, some people, they will go and they'll pick a curriculum, Alpha Omega, or one of the Bob Jones, you know, one of the other big curriculum companies, and they'll just stick with that the whole time and be done with it, because they know what to expect and their kids kind of have to conform to the way that those things are taught. On the other hand, there are some parents who will go around and have a more eclectic approach to it. And maybe they'll take science from one set of curriculum and math from another and history from another, which is more what we do. And then you actually have the unschoolers who don't do really any formal education. And it tends to be more interest-based. And so you have a young child who's growing up, and if they take an interest in the French and Indian War, they will then guide and direct that child to ways of learning history and science and things based on the French and Indian War. So there's a number of different approaches, and I wish I could say there's kind of one resource for that. But my recommendation would be to, if you have a state homeschool group, which you probably do, there's one in every state. You can go on their website. All you have to do is look up homeschooling and then the name of your state. And more than likely, you will find the big state homeschooling group. And they typically have meetings, local meetings where you can go and you can, if you're interested in homeschooling, you can talk to parents who homeschool, ask them about curriculum choices, and get advice on getting started.
One of the things that you offer through your podcast, The Wired Homeschool, is online workshops What sort of interaction do you have when you conduct an online workshop through the Wired Homeschool? And how might a homeschool group benefit from that type of seminar?
Yeah, so what happens is typically I have a couple of topics that I'll talk about with a homeschool group. And usually what we do is if you have a computer and a Skype connection, you can bring me into your homeschool group meeting. And I will give a presentation, but it's an interactive presentation. So you get to ask me questions while it's going on or at the end or however it may be. I recently did one for a homeschool conference in Washington State and had a great time doing that and presenting there and had some great questions asked. And so that's an opportunity for people to get someone, an expert, to speak to them about a particular topic without having to pay for travel and pay for all these other things and really get educated about some of the things that are going on with educational technology today, because it's pretty confusing out there right now, because you have parents who are giving devices to their kids that they don't know how to use. They don't know how to set up the parental controls on these devices. Mm-hmm. If kids using social media, parents don't know that their kids have these social media accounts. And if they're 13 or older, there's really nothing they can do about it, mm-hmm. which is even scarier because it's a privacy issue. So Facebook can't just turn over your 13-year-old daughter's Facebook records because privacy.
Right.
So there's a number of issues that I can talk about and hopefully provide some clarity on. And, I mean, I've had people ask me questions with specific examples. Someone said, I have a 16-year-old son. He's been using social media. How do I make him stop? And my response, well, that's kind of a parenting issue. Yeah. You know, that's
duct tape. We found
you can get rid of the internet at your house, I guess. Yeah. You know?
And
that
even
would be one way.
Yeah. But then you still get the cell phone contract. So,
exactly. Yeah, so it's just an opportunity for small homeschool groups to get someone like me to talk to them specifically on topics. And the great thing is, instead of just listening to my podcast and finding the one that you want to hear, I've got those topics listed there and you can ask me direct questions.
One final question, John, because I point out to listeners here that you're doing this on your lunch hour very graciously on a weekday. So I want to leave you at least a little bit of time to grab a snack bar or something. One of the truisms of life, I have seen this in my household, and I know that I, in fact, was guilty of this when I was young as well. The tendency for children not to believe something until they hear it from somebody other than mom or dad. My daughter is now 25, and I'm at the stage of her life where I'm beginning to get smarter again. How does a homeschooling parent deal with that in a classroom setting? Yeah, right, Mom. Until, you know, again, you hear it from an outside expert.
That can be pretty difficult at times, especially depending on what you're talking about. But typically what happens is most homeschoolers are using some kind of curriculum that has a textbook. And so mom's just kind of sharing what is coming out of the textbook. But there are cases where it's just typical teenage rebellion where they just don't want to listen to their parents. And I, for homeschoolers, it's no different, except that it can tend to be a little bit more ramped up because, like I said, you're spending most of your waking hours with your children now.
Yeah.
And so you hear it a lot more often.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just important to realize that, you know, God put you there as a mother, and whether or not you feel like it's happening or not, they are in fact absorbing what you're saying. And eventually, like you have observed, when they turn about 25, mm-hmm. they're going to come back and say, hey, you know, you were right about X, Y, and Z. I should have listened to you then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things, and I've said this before, that I consider near miraculous is that my father, who passed away in 2005, keeps getting smarter.
That is amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So it is a truism. You're planting seeds for the future, training them up in the way they should go. And when they're grown, they will not depart from it. John, you're doing great work there. I should mention to folks that the Wired Homeschool is now up over 150 episodes, and many of them are in the 5 to 15-minute range, so a modest investment of your time, but a wide range of topics pertaining to how to apply the tools and recommendations on tools to use to teach your children. And there is no greater investment in time. And, John, it's, again, an honor to talk to you, and I think an important time to talk to you now that the institution of homeschooling, because of one high-profile case, is once again in the news and being questioned by those who support the idea that all our children should be educated by the government.
Well, thanks again for having me, Derek. I think you and Sharon are doing a great job over there. And by the way, we need to get a studio tour, not only of the new recording studio here, but the television studio too. We got to get a studio tour. We got to see what that place looks like behind the scenes.
Well, it's in the process. It's top secret. It's under wraps. The new stuff is on a truck coming from the coast and supposed to arrive sometime this week. We're actually in the process at Skywatch TV of dismantling the existing studio for a new upgrade, which will be unveiled sometime this fall.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Check the show notes for a link to the Wired Homeschool podcast. Show notes always at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. Just a couple of things going on in the news. There were a couple of things that happened right at the end of the week, and we somehow overlooked this one as Sharon and I put up a new PID radio podcast yesterday afternoon. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, signed a bill on Friday afternoon, which is pretty significant, I think. It establishes a new gold and silver depository in the state of Texas. And this is the first precious metals depository at the state level in the country. This bill will also, and this is the significant part, repatriate about $1 billion in gold bullion that's currently on deposit with the New York branch of the Federal Reserve Bank, sitting in a vault at HSBC Bank in New York. This will transfer the bullion, the physical gold, from New York back to Texas. The gold is owned by the University of Texas Endowment, and there's some pretty shrewd operators on the board of directors for this fund. They're looking at the situation around the world, and the articles that I read about this kind of dance around the subject, but it seems like the underlying assumption is that there's more gold being traded on world markets than actually exists. And so the board of directors of the University of Texas Endowment, doing their due diligence, decided they would like to have their hands on the gold rather than on the paper promissory notes. The other interesting part of this bill signed into law by Governor Abbott on Friday is that it would make illegal any attempt to confiscate the gold, which, if you know your history, you're aware the federal government did in 1933 as part of the bank holiday to try to drag the United States out of the Great Depression. So this could potentially set up an interesting legal confrontation between the government and the state of Texas at some point in the future. I don't know that the federal government wants to confiscate gold again, but if it should do so, the state of Texas, officials in the state of Texas, would not be allowed to do so under state law. So very interesting little development there. Put a story in the daily update today at Skywatch TV. If you watch those video updates that I put up 5 times a week, they're generally run about 10 minutes long. Try not to make them so long that it's a burden to sit and watch. But there was an interesting story that I came across over the weekend that I had to include as a follow-up to the Texas gold story, and that is the company out there called Vivos that is selling spaces in doomsday bunkers that are appointed like a 4-star hotel. You know, the federal government has its continuity of government redoubts or bunkers located in an arc about 45 minutes away from Washington, D.C., Mount Weather in West Virginia, Site R at Raven Rock, Pennsylvania. There are others for those government officials and bureaucrats deemed too valuable to lose when the big one falls. But this company has identified a market amongst the world's wealthy for a similar type of protection. They've got one site in Indiana that has space for 80 people up to a year, equipped with medical facilities, kitchen, exercise facilities, a theater, basically enough food and a deep well for water to allow people, 80 people, to stay there for up to a year without having to return to the surface. The advertising promotes the fact that it's far away from any obvious nuclear targets, also a safe distance away from the New Madrid Fault and the Mississippi River, so that presumably you wouldn't have to worry about rivers washing into this underground bunker and flooding the people out. Also surrounded by good fishing and hunting. Don't know exactly where this is. There's a video on the website for the company that, featured on a cable show about people preparing for the apocalypse, but they made the film crew turn off any device that had GPS chips in it, and then they blindfolded the crew so they couldn't identify where the bunker was located. Presumably, when things get really bad, those of us on the outside will be trying to find our way in, and that would just be, no good. There it is. I mean, it's like Revelation 6, where the kings of the earth and the generals and the powerful are basically, calling out to the mountains and the rocks to fall on us, to hide us from the face of the one who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? A sixth seal scenario, if you will. Cost, by the way, if you're looking for a spot, is $35,000 if you're an adult, $25,000 per child, a one-time fee. Although it seems that if you've got some useful skills, military, medical, security, or mechanical, they might cut you a deal on the price. When the day comes, those who are looking for that kind of safety and security won't find it at any price. War and rumors of war. The rebellion in Ukraine broke out again over the weekend. The rebels, backed by Russia, striking out to the southwest of their headquarters city of Donetsk. And the intelligence company Stratfor is warning that things there might be getting dicier than we suspect. While the rebels in the eastern part of Ukraine, backed by Russia, have been taking territory away from the government, there is on Ukraine's western border, the territory between Ukraine and Moldova. And I had to look this up on a map. I should know where it is, because this area is exactly where my mother's parents, or not parents, but grandparents, emigrated from in the late 19th century, around 1894. They were the Germans that emigrated to Russia at the invitation of Catherine the Great in the early 1800s. And they lived there for about 75, 80 years, and then realized that, hey, the Russians are conscripting our kids into the army, which they promised they wouldn't do. So they left and headed for the Dakotas. Anyway, this area is called Transnistria, and it's a breakaway province from Moldova in the same way that South Ossetia was a breakaway province from the country of Georgia back in 2008. And ethnically, there are a lot of Russians living in this area, which I guess is why they're agitating for independence. And they are more or less self-determining now. But while you've got I guess they're taking advantage of the situation in Ukraine with the rebels in the eastern part of Ukraine causing trouble. The people in Transnistria are saying, hey, we can do this too. And over the weekend, it appeared that Ukraine was moving military assets to their western border, the border with Transnistria. Moldova's making noise like they're not happy about these Transnistrians agitating for independence again. They actually fought a war back in 90 and 91, and Russia's had about 14,000 peacekeepers based in Transnistria since then. The thing that's making things a little complicated is that the Russians have been supplying these troops via a land route through Ukraine. And Ukraine, because of Russia's support for the rebels, has closed their borders to Russian trucks. So Russia's been flying supplies to their troops, but they've been flying them from their base in Crimea, which they took away from Ukraine here recently. So Ukraine's not happy about that. And they're flying through Ukrainian airspace, which they're not happy about. Well, Ukraine just deployed an S-300 anti-aircraft missile system near Odessa. Odessa's on the Black Sea. It's very close to this area that we're talking about. And that kind of ups the ante a little bit, because if Russia's flying across Ukrainian airspace and the Ukrainians have this anti-missile or anti-aircraft missile system, they could potentially shoot down a Russian plane, which would make things real hot real quick. The other thing that's complicating matters is that for some reason, the Ukrainian government, led by President Petro Poroshenko, just appointed a gentleman named Mikhail Saakashvili, the governor of Odessa. Mikhail Saakashvili is the former president of Georgia. He was president of Georgia in 2008 when Georgia sent troops into South Ossetia, where Russia also had peacekeeping troops stationed. That led to a brief war between Russia and Georgia back in 2008, you might remember. Most American commentators on the right blamed Russia, but it's pretty well documented fact that Georgia attacked and Russia defended. So putting Saakashvili in charge of an area where there's already a buildup of tension and a buildup of Ukrainian troops on the border of an area where Russian troops are also stationed leads to a potentially dangerous situation. And that's what Stratfor is saying. They're saying this could lead to a wider conflict, bringing NATO into direct conflict with Russia. And while that's going on, the Pentagon is proposing to deploy heavy weapons in Eastern Europe for the first time since the Cold War. We're talking tanks, infantry fighting vehicles, enough weaponry to equip about 5,000 American soldiers, which compared to the resources that Russia has in the area is really a drop in the bucket. Frankly, what it amounts to is a tripwire, where if the Russians decide they're going to send their troops into the Baltics, there would be enough American forces there for them to stop and think, do we want to instigate a war with the United States? And I think that's the point. So things are ratcheting up. And just one final note, House Intelligence Committee voted unanimously at the end of last week to cut funding to the CIA for its secret program, not so secret anymore, to train Syrian rebels in Jordan. Apparently, the CIA has been spending about $1 billion a year on its program in Syria, which is about 7% of the agency's total budget. The House Intelligence Committee just sending a message. They want to cut that budget by about 20%. But the fact that it was a unanimous vote instead of a party line vote, in other words, all of the Democrats on the committee also voted to cut the CIA's budget, indicates that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans, the Republicans you would expect, but the Democrats in the House are not confident of the president's strategy in Syria. And considering that the CIA's program, which was to train and arm Syrian rebels, we now know, thanks to Judicial Watch, actually provided the training and the material needed to help convert al-Qaeda in Iraq into the Islamic State, it's no wonder that they're asking some questions. What a tangled web. Anyway, coming up on A View from the Bunker, we talk with the lessons of history and what we learn or fail to learn from them. John McTernan, first time we've talked to John in quite some time. We were, we were with him on the Quest for Truth virtual conference. John gave a presentation there, but I'd spoken to him previously about his book, As America Has Done to Israel, and have not spoken to him really one-to-one since then. So he's a really interesting guy, and he's doing some good work that deserves your attention. So that interview will come up on Wednesday the 17th. John McTernan here on A View from the Bunker. And we are hoping that this week we'll be able to confirm an interview with Reverend Dr. Christopher Benick. He's a Presbyterian minister who wrote an essay recently in the Christian Post that the time has come for Christians to embrace transhumanism. That, of course, got my attention, but he followed that up with another essay just published over the weekend that a vote for the Transhumanist Party candidate for president is a vote for totalitarianism. So his position is a little more nuanced than I thought at first, and definitely want to find out more about that. So hoping we can talk with him and get that to you in the very near future. The Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study, now a podcast only, thanks to the satellite internet connection at home, does not handle live webcasting very easily, but we hope you'll join us. We post the new study on Sunday mornings, runs about an hour. We're working our way through the book of Leviticus right now and looking at how the law handed to Moses was what it was intended to do, the significance of it, the importance God places on holiness, and especially the sanctity, his sanctity, and how important it is. I mean, it was so important back in the day that he literally burned two sons of Aaron alive for performing an unauthorized task in the holy place. Sounds harsh, but he was making a point, a lesson. It was a hard lesson, and a hard one especially for Aaron. That's about where we are in the Bible at this point as we continue our chronological study of the Bible. We generally will post those by mid-morning on Sundays, and we hope you'll join us. GilbertHouse.org is the website. You can subscribe to the podcast there through a link on the webpage. Skywatch TV, the weekly broadcast that will air tomorrow night, Tuesday night, 8:30 p.m. Central Time. That's UTC-5 on the Christian Television Network. Steve Quayle joining Tom Horn for another discussion. That's DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267. Follows our good friends at Prophecy Watchers on the Christian Television Network. You can also watch it live at ctnonline.com. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.